track session number 27344, reel 15.
Robert Candless, reel 15.
Well, we were talking about my being back at Leon Solent in 801 Squadron, getting ready to go out to Korea. And I had fallen for this girl that I met on a blind date. And although I didn't intend to become involved, on the Sunday before we were leaving to go, we decided to get married the following Saturday. So we had 6 days to get ready. Needless to say, both our parents assumed that she was pregnant. And we had the wedding at Leon Solent, and it was an absolute total shambles from start to finish. On the Wednesday, I still didn't have a church to get married in. Anyway, we found a church. On the Saturday morning, I went to collect the wedding cake, which I'd ordered from a local bakery. And they said, oh yes, here it is. And they gave it to me, and it was a wedding cake, a flat iced cake with no decorations at all. I said, well, where are the decorations? They said, oh, that's not our responsibility. I said, do you think I carry them around in my kit bag? I said, you better find some decorations and I'll come back for it in an hour. Anyway, they did it, and they did it very well. And we got married, and we went over to the Isle of Wight for our honeymoon to Seaview. And we were there all of Sunday, and then Monday I had to be back because we were flying off to Malta to do our training for Korea. But very luckily, my wife was able to come out to Malta, and a friend of mine that I had made when I was out there as a brewer lent us the flat. And we had this flat overlooking Grand Harbour. And we were there for, I think, probably 6 weeks. And it was an absolutely glorious time. We thoroughly enjoyed it because we were working what they call tropical routine, which is start at 6 in the morning and finish at 2 in the afternoon. And, of course, from 2 o'clock we were off swimming or whatever it was. And it really was a marvellous time. And we were just carrying on doing what we had to do in training, both from ashore and from the ship. And the ship was HMS Glory. And she used to come into Grand Harbour quite often. And I would go ashore from the ship and just walk up the hill to the flat, and that was great. But a couple of times I didn't walk down soon enough. I can remember one occasion where the ship was actually leaving harbour, and I got a dicer to take me across the harbour to one of the tugs which was manoeuvring the Glory to get her out of the harbour. So I jumped on the stern of the tug and went up to see the captain, and I said, when you nose along either the quarterdeck or the forecastle, can I jump off your bow onto the ship? And he said, yeah, of course you can. So he got alongside the bow of the ship and nosed right in and put his buffer on the ship, and I stepped over from the tug onto the carrier. And nobody knew I wasn't there at the right time. Anyway, we went off and did our flying training again. So that was really quite an enjoyable time again. So you can understand that I enjoyed most of my time in the Fleet Air Arm.
What was the Glory like? Because obviously the carriers that you'd operated on in the wartime period were...
Well, the Glory, of course, was the same class as the Colossus. And I'd been in the Colossus for over a year. The Glory was very similar, a light fleet carrier. When I say light fleet, it meant it wasn't armoured to the same extent as the big ships. But the deck was nearly as long and nearly as broad, but made of much lighter metal. And it's surprising how, once you've been operating on the ship for some time, you could see dimples in the deck where the metal had bent between the ribs. And that used to be a bit of a nuisance, particularly up at the forward end, because when the aircraft were being fired off on the catapult, obviously the main wheels and the weight of the aircraft were down the same tracks for every launch. So it was getting to the point where the metal was bending between the ribs, which meant that the main undercarriage was juddering as it was fired off, to the extent that it was causing hydraulic leaks. So they had to find some way of smoothing off, levelling off the deck. And that was the first time I ever heard of epoxy resin, which is what they brought in to do it. And they just levelled it off and made all the difference. It didn't matter that the rest of the deck was dimpled, because generally speaking, you weren't going over at a high speed. Or if you were, you'd just landed on and were being stopped rapidly. But at the catapult, it was quite tricky. Anyway, the Glory was a lovely ship to fly from, and we had a most excellent ship's company, and we got on very well with them.
What about accommodation, living conditions?
Well, as far as I was concerned, I was a lieutenant, a reasonably senior lieutenant by that time, and I was sharing a cabin. There was two of us. Some of the more junior officers were in cabins of four, but we didn't have dormitories like we had in the Furious, nothing like that at all. And the accommodation was on, well, you'd be spread over four decks, right up to being immediately under the flight deck. And my cabin was at the after end, under the flight deck, right beside the aircraft lift, which was a bit of a nuisance, because every time the lift went up or down, there's a clanging bell to warn people that the lift is moving. And this clanging bell used to ring through our cabin as if it was in the cabin. And again, when aircraft landed on, you'd hear the thump of the hook hitting the deck, and then the scream of the wire as it was pulled out by the aircraft. So having a relaxed time in the cabin was only possible when there was no flying. But the air conditioning was quite good. It wasn't brilliant, but it could bring the temperature down from 120, which was good. But it was more, I suppose, ventilation than air conditioning, really. Yeah, ventilation. Wasn't too bad, but if the nights were very hot, we used to take our camp bed out onto the open decks and sleep on the open decks, which was fine, except in the monsoon when you could get caught out and soaked quite quickly. But generally speaking, as far as I was concerned, the cabin was good. The wardroom was just about big enough for the number of officers we had. I mean, when all the officers were in there, it was really quite full. And the wardroom anteroom, of course, would fill up quite quickly. And in those days, most people seemed to smoke. And the level of smoke in the anteroom came absolutely appalling. And you probably know that the deckhead, the ceilings in carriers are not very high, probably 7 feet, and with pipes and stuff below it. But gradually the smoke would come down from 7 feet to 6 feet to 5 feet to 4 feet, and you'd be sitting like this underneath it trying to keep your head out of the smoke. And far too many people had a very bad habit of throwing their dog end into one of these big shell cases which acted as ashtrays. And they would just throw the dog end, still lit, into the ashtray, and it would smoulder away there. And the acrid smoke coming out was absolutely appalling. So somebody would pour some beer into it and put the cigarette out, but that then made a mess.
And what about, would you have a steward? Or
yes.
To do your...
We had one steward looking after probably six officers, maybe eight. And we had a steward looking after us, and he would, generally speaking, tidy up the cabin and do the laundry and that sort of thing. But again, he would waken us, and if we were doing night flying or something like that, it was the steward that made sure we were awake and dressed in time to go. But they were very good, very helpful, and I really got on extremely well with them.
Did they tend to be older, seamen?
No. No, they about our age, actually. We had our own stewards in the squadron, so that if we were moved ashore, the stewards came with us. And we had our own cooks and stewards and aircraft handlers who were also drivers. And we had a complete unit which could go ashore and operate ashore and not put too much of a strain on the station we were going to, because we took ancillary people with us. And we certainly had our own air mechanics and that sort of thing.
So am I right in thinking it's almost like two separate things on there?
Oh, yes. Oh, very much so. And this is what I said. We were lucky in glory because the air department got on very well with the ship's departments. And that didn't always happen. There was sometimes quite severe rivalry between the ship's company and the air department. And one of the things that used to get right up the noses of the air department, we'd be flying and flying busily, and you'd hear a pipe on the broadcast saying, "Hands to making men clothes." And this is the seamen who weren't doing anything because we were at sea and they weren't handling ropes, they weren't doing else. And they were being given a half day. And the silly people would make a broadcast to tell us, who were working bloody hard, that they were having a half day off.
And what about the seamen branches? What would the air branch upset them with?
Oh, I don't know. Generally, we required actions which were upsetting their routines. That was mainly. We weren't getting in their way, but we used to really upset their routines. And to someone who is used to living and working by a routine, that is very upsetting. But again, you see, we used to, when we were in non-flying periods, we had two ways of having exercise. One was deck hockey, and we used to clear the wires off the deck and play deck hockey, and there was always rivalry between the officers and the ratings and between the air department and the ship's departments. And we had a little league running, and you'd have the stokers playing the aircraft handlers and the cooks and stewards playing the officers or something like this, you know. And there was certainly always a bit of needle in these matches. But the other thing that we used to play was volleyball. And what we used to do was to put the afterlift down and rig a net across and play volleyball down there. And we used to have to stuff different things round the side of the lift so that the ball didn't go underneath the lift, because that was always a bloody nuisance, because you had to unrig everything, take the lift up far enough to get underneath, and then put the lift down again, re-rig the net and everything else, and get on with the game. So we had to sort of block the holes down the side. But we used to have great volleyball games. And when we were watching, we would sit around the edge of the lift with our legs dangling over the side, and then there'd be a row standing behind you. So you get two rows looking down into the lift, watching the game. And they were great games, really, really good games of volleyball, six-a-side. And again, terrific competition between the officers and the ratings and the ship's company and the air department, and between squadrons and the air department. Very considerable rivalry. Anyway, on the way out to Korea, we again stopped at Malta and worked up there, and then on in through Suez and out. And we stopped at various places showing the flag. Stopped, for example, at Karachi. We were there for 2 days, and then on down to Colombo, and we were there for 2 days, and then down to Singapore, and we were there for 4 days. Up to Hong Kong, and we were there for 3 or 4 days, and then on up to Korea.
Could I ask about your brother officers, your brother pilots, and observers? Were they all at that time, or was there a proportion of Second World War veterans like yourself?
Oh, yes.
Or was there younger?
I suppose about a quarter of us had been wartime, and the others were post-war. And it worked out very well. We had great camaraderie and friendship in the squadrons. Friendships that you made last for the rest of your life, really.
And would the ones who had not seen any kind of active service, would they ask advice of yourselves?
Yes. Oh, generally speaking, you would, if you were starting to talk about it, you'd be sort of giving advice while you were talking without really thinking about it. But I can remember once we had a new CEO in the squadron, and he had only learned to fly since the war. He was an RN officer who volunteered for the Fleet Air Arm, and he was a tank commander, and he had had two number twos shot down in Korea in quite quick succession. And he took me to one side one day and asked what he was doing wrong that was causing this major problem. So we spoke about his way of making his attacks and finding out what he did and how he did it, and then telling him how I did mine. But we had quite a number shot down while we were out there. And I suppose many of them were number twos rather than leaders, just the way things were.
But it was perceived as an important thing to pass on your experience.
Oh, yes, definitely. I think so. I think it's absolutely essential, because there's no way things develop if you don't do that. But anyway, on the way out, as I said, there was always rivalry between the squadrons. And we had the Sea Fury squadron I was in, and 826 Firefly squadron. And when we set off from Malta to go out to the Far East, two squadrons decided to have a beer growing competition. And this was going to be judged on Christmas Day when we got out in the Far East. So we had 3 months to grow beards. And when we got to the day of judgment, we lined up across the quarterdeck in what we thought was the superiority of our beards, some really thick ones on the right and some really sparse ones on the left, you know. And I finished up somewhere in the middle of this row. And the captain and the commander started at the right-hand side and looked at the beards and walked down and got down, and they stopped in front of me and then looked at me. And they had a quick chat with one another, and then they both agreed, and they said, right, you can keep your beard from here to the left, shave off. So, of course, in the Navy, you've got to get the captain's permission, both to agree to grow a beard and to shave off, so that everybody knows which condition you're supposed to be in. But anyway, I grew my beard at Christmas 52 and I've kept it since. But another thing about the beard, when we were coming back from Korea, the commander said to me, are you shaving off when you get back? And I said, oh no, I intend to keep it. He says, well, I'll let you keep it so long as you get permission in writing from your wife. So I had to write to my wife and ask her to write permission for me to keep my beard, which she did. But anyway, do you want me to go on to the Korean business? Well, we went out and we left from Hong Kong and went up into the sea, Yellow Sea, just to the west coast of Korea. And of course, we'd taken on board army officers who were briefing us in the targets and showing us the maps and the areas that we were covering. And the intention, our intention, the Fleet Air Arm intention, was to stop the movement of all traffic on the west coast, so that we were stopping ammunition getting from North Korea to the front line. So we were flying over North Korea all the time. And we were doing what was usually called interdiction. And that was finding something that was moving and shoot at it, or drop bombs on railway bridges, road bridges, or if possible, put them up railway tunnels. And that was good fun. I enjoyed doing that. And we were shown the sort of area that we would be on the maps, the area we would be covering, and where there were places on the coast where there were South Korean detachments, so that if we were going to fall into the sea, we had to try and fall into the sea somewhere near to them if we could, and they would send a boat to pick us up. And also they pointed out the island where the Americans had rescue helicopters, and they did a marvellous job. Now, they are brave men, because they were flying in relatively slow-moving aircraft right into the thick of it to pick people out who'd been shot down. And they did, and they were there, and the North Koreans would be there firing at them, doing their best to dissuade them or even to knock out the aircraft. And I think they were very, very brave men. Anyway, we got this brief on what was going on, and there was always an element of excitement before you start these things. Apprehension, I suppose, to begin with, because you had no idea what you were going to meet. And with those who hadn't been doing anything during the war, they were probably a bit more keyed up than we were. So it was a matter of just talking amongst ourselves and just trying to keep the atmosphere fairly light.
Was that important?
Oh, yes, I think so. I would think it's terrible to leave somebody moping in a corner worrying about what's going to happen next day. I don't think that's a good thing at all.
Again, with people like yourself who had experience, I take it that the idea was to not let them know too much about what could occur.
Well, we didn't know. I mean, it was new to us as well, really. I mean, compared with what I had done in Barracudas during the war, this was a different war. And although we didn't know what we were going into, we knew the experience of going into an unknown situation. And it was just a matter of, as I say, trying to keep the atmosphere light. And then we had, we were flying off probably 10 aircraft at a time. That would be 4 Sea Furies, 4 Fireflies, and 2 Sea Furies acting as combat air patrol over the fleet. And sometimes we would fly off another group of Sea Furies, fly off 8 Furies, and they would go and act as a combat air patrol over the front line. And they were just waiting there for the army to call them and say, we're firing red smoke onto the front line. Where you see it, we're having bother with something or other there. Would you attack that? So you'd fly around, wait till you saw the red smoke, and then they'd come back and say, can you see the red smoke? 3 o'clock from that, 200 yards, there is a gun position. Fire your rockets or drop your bombs or whatever you're going to do on that. And that was over the front line. But over the fleet, over the ships, these two aircraft would just orbit for the full time and be there in case aircraft came to investigate the ships. And then they would go and intercept the aircraft.
Were there any cases of that?
One only that we had, only one. And it was a couple of MiG jets that came over, but they stayed high. And obviously they reported our position, but there was nothing the Sea Furies could do about it. They were flying around at 15 or 20,000 feet, and the MiGs were coming over at 35,000. And even if they had got up there, they wouldn't have been able to keep up with them. But anyway, the cap was always there. And the aircraft going and flying ashore, the 4 Furies and the 4 Fireflies, were all given primary targets and secondary targets. And the primary targets would be usually bridges or tunnels or a known concentration of troops. And we would go and find the target and deliver the weapons we had. The Fireflies used to carry rockets quite a lot. But we, generally speaking, carried bombs. And they were 250-pound bombs. And they could be fitted with delayed action. And what we used to do would be to drop 3 which would explode immediately and 1 delayed action bomb, so that if we dropped on a railway bridge or something like that, the delayed action one wouldn't blow up till the middle of the night, in the hope that they were there trying to repair the bridge when the other bomb went off. And you'd do much the same when you were putting bombs up into a tunnel, but that was a low-level approach. You would come in low level straight at the tunnel entrance until you got as close as you dared get to it, and then release the bombs and hope that they were going to go up the tunnel and explode as far into the tunnel as they could go. And we were doing that quite regularly because we knew that they were hiding ammunition trains in the tunnel ready to move them south. So we were trying to get the bomb up that would cause the ammunition train to explode. But I don't think we ever achieved it. But we used to block the entrances regularly.
Because that sounds quite a difficult task.
Not really, not really.
How would you make an approach to a railway tunnel? I know you said straight on, but surely there's well, the bottom of the...
You knew where the... from the map, you knew the layout of the railway and if there was a straight run into it or whatever it was, because you had the hills marked either side. And usually the railways are running along the valleys. And you just had to come up the valley and you perhaps came over the top of a hill down into the valley. And it, you didn't have a long straight run in, but so long as you had 4 or 5 seconds straight and level, you were in a position to be able to drop the bombs reasonably accurately so that you could at least hit the surrounds of the entrance, even if you didn't put a bomb up the tunnel. But we just hoped that one would go up the tunnel anyway. But we could usually, by that time, we were well in practice. I mean, you could be sure that the bombs would be within 5 yards of what you were aiming at, as a general rule. But the railway bridges were always very difficult because they were very open support work. And unless you actually hit the support work, you weren't going to knock it down. If you dropped a bomb, even within 3 or 4 yards of it, the blast would just go through the open work and not actually damage the bridge. So to damage the bridge, you actually had to hit it. And let's face it, the rails are 3 feet wide and the sleepers are another foot, so you're talking about 5 feet wide. And there was very seldom a bridge which was, had two rails over it, usually the one rail. And not all the rivers were wide, some of them were quite narrow, some of them were streams. But we were still trying to knock out bridges. And those were difficult targets. And even dropping 4 bombs, you couldn't be certain that you were actually going to hit it. But finding troop concentrations, that was usually very easy. And we'd also find places where they had stored stuff alongside the railway line. And that was just a matter of flying up that firing cannon into all this stuff and hope that perhaps you'd find some ammunition there that would blow it up. But you used to start fires and that sort of thing. And that was really what it was about. Just doing everything we could to hinder their movement of men and materials on the West Coast.
Obviously, travelling at the speed you were attacking at, what can you see on the ground at that kind of speed?
Oh, you can see people clearly, very clear. I mean, the sort of thing, another thing that they used to do was they used to give men 2 shells to carry, you know, cannon shells. And they would walk around as if they were farmers or whatever, walking south. So if you saw a number of them walking south, we would attack them because we would assume that they were soldiers carrying ammunition to the next dump. And as I say, you could see them quite clearly. But trying to hit them, of course, was a different matter because a man on the ground is quite a small target. But it was mainly a matter of firing cannon amongst them in the hope that you were hitting some of them and putting the rest off.
Was there much vehicle transport on the roads?
Not a lot. What there was mainly ox carts. But we would occasionally see motor vehicles, lorries, and of course they were an ideal target, and you could usually get those with cannon fire. But again, you see, ox carts could be farmers, but they might have been carrying anything. So we used to dissuade them from moving as well.